All right, we are ready for our next case on the docket, which is Pierce versus Parrish. And are the attorneys present and ready? Thank you. All right, as I had indicated previously, there is a lighting system on here. The appellant may reserve time if they would like. When the light turns yellow, it means there are 5 minutes remaining. When the light turns red, that means your time is up. And if there is anyone in the courtroom who has any cell phones, if you can turn those off so as not to interrupt the argument. And there was another matter I just wanted to address before you begin your arguments today. The court was in receipt of a motion to supplement the record, and the court will be denying that as the trial court below did not have that information before it. All right. Okay. We're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lisa Secor. I'm attorney for the appellant, Richard Pierce. My Colorado bar number is 25394. I've been an attorney since 1987. I did represent Mr. Pierce in the case below after a certain period of time. This case was decided on summary judgment, and I won't go into the details of the brief as I know you've reviewed them. I would say I do want to address one thing that I don't think came out in the brief. And overall, I would just say a legal malpractice claim evokes a visceral response, especially in us attorneys. And sometimes our policy or our belief system drives the conclusion. And that may have been what happened by the trial court. Overall, I think the crux of the issue is that there is a distinction between knowing that legal malpractice has occurred and knowing whether you have been damaged by that legal malpractice. And what I think doesn't come out in the brief is the context of the situation in April of 05 through May of 05. In April of 05, Mr. Pierce had been informed by his attorney that he had failed to answer a motion in limine in the previous November. The trial had been set for December of 04 and had been continued. In that process, Attorney Parrish had forgot or had just left the motion in limine go unresponded to. The court had ruled on that motion in limine, but the court didn't rule on it based on a failure to answer. He didn't rule on it as a default. He considered all the legal issues and all the arguments pro and con, and ultimately decided a particular phone conversation that Mr. Pierce had overheard saying that the company was trying to get him would be excluded from evidence because of the attorney-client privilege. So Mr. Pierce was informed not until April of the following year that that motion had been denied and that Mr. Parrish had failed to respond to it. He informed Mr. Pierce at that time, I've notified my legal malpractice carrier. So Mr. Pierce was aware that the attorney was concerned about malpractice. And look what the court did below and what Mr. Parrish argues before you now. He says, because Mr. Pierce was aware that I committed legal malpractice, therefore the statute of limitations began to run. That's not enough, because first of all, you have to decide whether there was actionable malpractice that occurred at the time. For example, let's say in April of 05, Mr. Pierce had tried to file a legal malpractice claim against his attorney right then and there. Would that claim have been actionable? No, because there was no damage that resulted from that motion in limine. The trial hadn't occurred yet. The evidence hadn't been presented. This was a case, the overall underlying case in the legal malpractice case, the Tyco case is what I refer to it as. That was a case where Mr. Pierce, as an officer of a corporation, was sued for personal liability because the corporation had filed bankruptcy. There are a lot of defenses to personal liability for corporate debts. At trial, Mr. Parrish could have represented Mr. Pierce and established that the company had followed all the protocols for corporate protections. He could have established that as a minor shareholder and as an officer of the corporation, he didn't have any duty to pay those debts personally. He could have showed that Mr. Pierce didn't do anything to cause the debt to occur. And as a fact, he could have shown that Tyco, which was a corporate raider at the time, that Tyco had actively gone in and tried to steal these assets and wasn't entitled to any kind of relief from Mr. Pierce personally. So a lot had yet to be done in the case as of April of 05. And Mr. Parrish wants to cherry pick the language out of that letter from Mr. Pierce and say, see, he knew about malpractice, therefore 2 years later, statute of limitations ran. But if you look at the gist of that letter, and also look at that in context of the withdrawal hearing that the attorneys had with Judge Munch in May of 2005, you could see what was going on in Mr. Pierce's mind. He was told his attorneys had committed malpractice. He didn't understand what that meant. He told the judge at the withdrawal hearing in May, what I see is my attorney getting a fight with his firm. The firm partners are saying one thing, some of it which I know was not true. The attorney's saying another thing, and he's telling me he can fix it. And I don't know what to believe. I feel like I'm caught in the middle of basically a domestic dispute or a breakup of attorneys, like a domestic dispute, of a breakup of attorneys. So all I want is I know Mr. Parrish is a really good attorney, and I know if he puts his effort and mind into it, he can win this case for me. I know how complicated this case is because I've been in it all along, and it will not survive if they don't stay and represent me, given where we are in the case. Originally, a request for continuance of the trial was not granted, and it was going to go forward. Later, it was moved back. Ultimately, the case settled in July of 2005. But it's very important because the state of Mr. Pierce's mind is clear from that withdrawal hearing held in May of 2005, which occurred within the statute of limitations period. The complaint was filed May 7th. I think the hearing was May 17th. So if you look at what Mr. Pierce knew and what was actionable in 2005, it's clear that he had an actionable claim after May 7th of 2005. And the actionable claim is that Mr. Parrish was ordered, expressly and directly ordered by the trial court to remain representing Mr. Pierce. And he was ordered to enter his entry of appearance separate from his firm. But he had never withdrawn. He was still attorney of record for Mr. Pierce through the entire case. So his failure to show up and represent Mr. Pierce, even though he was attorney of record, is what caused Mr. Pierce's damage. For example, he could have simply, he had done a lot of work. And we got to keep in mind, the way, it's kind of ironic, the way Mr. Parrish presents the facts is as if it was such gross, terrible negligence. The attorney knew of the negligence and he knew of the damages and he should have sued within 2 years. But if you look at what really was going on at the time, he had actually had accomplished a lot of things in the case. Tyco had dismissed a number of their significant claims against Mr. Pierce, including the alter ego claims. So the defense was getting diminished right along. So all Mr. Pierce had to do is stick with Mr. Pierce, continue that defense, and it's likely he would have got him completely out of the lawsuit. And we got to keep in mind, there were counterclaims that had been brought on Mr. Pierce's behalf. Counterclaims with the breach of contract that he personally had with Tyco, and for the damages caused by Tyco's actions as a corporate raider. Therefore, not only the end result, Mr. Pierce was forced to represent himself at the end of the case. He thought all was lost based on what Mr. Parrish, his attorney, had told him. And so he said, That's it. I just got to get out of this. And so he settled for $44,000. $44,000 happens to be the amount in escrow that had been placed there during this process. Mr. Pierce had gotten a divorce, and the house was sold. Mrs. Pierce's amount from the house was given to her. There was a motion right about this time to that effect. And then the remaining portion that was Mr. Pierce's was put in escrow. That was $44,000. He said, fine, you just keep it and let's just walk away from this. So that was a settlement that was entered into in July of 2005.
Ms. Seascore, let me ask you this. Is it the settlement that you are arguing is the damage in this case? Because you introduced this saying there's a distinction between act and damage. And if you can just talk about that a little bit more, is what legally is considered knowledge of damage?
To me, you have to first look at the actionable injury. The actionable injury was Mr. Parrish's failure to remain representing Mr. Pierce. What would have happened if he would have remained and had showed up and come to the aid of Mr. Pierce? What would have happened is he would have succeeded on defending against all of plaintiff's claims. In other words, he wouldn't have had to pay any damages. That is the settlement amount. So at least $44,000. In addition, he had a personal claim for the breach of contract with Tyco. He had an employment contract with them. So I don't think it's in the record of what that amount was, but whatever damages he could claim for that employment contract, he could have gotten those damages as well by simply prevailing on his counterclaim against Tyco.
Okay, so your position is that the statute of limitations would begin running at what point in time?
The actionable injury occurred when Mr. Parrish failed to appear. The earliest date that would be is May 17, 2005 at the withdrawal hearing, because at that point in time, Mr. Pierce knew that Mr. Parrish was ordered to stay and represent him. And it was at that point in time when things started to happen and fall in place, where motions for reconsideration were denied, further pretrial motions were resolved against him. For example, the court had ruled that witnesses Haley and one other ones were barred. One of them because Mr. Parrish had failed to disclose to the other side the location of the witness, and he had failed to get a trial deposition of that witness who was out of state, and that was a key witness on the counterclaim. So Mr. Pierce didn't know about those events until after he took over his own representation and the court ruled on it in the orders. One might have been the end of May, but one of the orders was definitely June 28th, 2005, where a lot of the issues were decided. But they were both after May 17th of 2005. And in fact, at the hearing for the withdrawal of the law firm, Mr. Parrish was informed by Judge Munch that, I believe, by the judge, excuse me if I have that wrong, Mr. Pierce was informed by the judge that the rules of professional responsibility had been breached and that he may have a claim against Mr. Parrish. And he instructed Mr. Parrish to enter his appearance as an individual attorney since he had just split with a firm, and it was at that hearing that the court allowed the partners of the law firm and the newly formed firm to withdraw.
Was Mr. Pierce proceeding on any acts of negligence that occurred before that May 05 date?
No. I don't think he could. For example, at the beginning of the Tyco case, the first thing Mr. Parrish did is file a motion to dismiss. It was so bad that he actually alleged facts that weren't true. He said that Tyco had entered into a settlement agreement with Mr. Pierce's corporation that absolved him of personal liability. All you have to do is read the settlement agreement. It has expressed language that says Mr. Pierce is not being personally relieved of personal responsibility by this agreement. So I mean, it was just a complete misrepresentation to the court, and obviously the motion to dismiss was denied. So I don't believe we could have alleged that as malpractice in our case that was denied on summary judgment because the statute of limitations had run on that. However, that may not be true because Mr. Pierce did not learn about that until much later. In fact, Mr. Parrish told because the motion to dismiss was so bad, the court entered sanctions against Mr. Parrish for attorney's fees and costs. Mr. Parrish never told Mr. Pierce about it. He never informed him. In their meeting in April of 2005, he told him, "Oh, I paid sanctions for you." The only reason it came up is because Tyco's attorneys said, "Hey, you never paid those attorney's fees and costs. You need to pay those up." And so the attorney told Mr. Pierce about it and said, "Oh, I've got your back. I'm taking care of you. I even paid these sanctions." But he didn't tell him what those sanctions were for or that it was because of his bad motion that caused it. And so that might have been a bad example of what couldn't have been brought. But there's no claim for the failure to file the motion, for the failure to respond to the motion in limine. You know, motion in limines are a moving target. You could argue, even if you're denied a motion in limine pretrial, you can bring it up again at trial and the court may reconsider. This particular judge showed a proclivity to reconsider motions.
Okay, Ms. Seeker, thank you. Your time is up.
Oh, thank you.
May it please the court, Ian Hicks on behalf of the appellees, attorney registration number 39332. If it may please the court, this case is a very simple case. It involves the accrual of a legal malpractice claim. There's only two requirements under Colorado law for an accrual of a legal malpractice claim. Number one, the client must have knowledge of facts that would put a reasonable person on notice that they've suffered some damage, and number two, that damage was the result of the wrongful act of the attorney. In this case, the facts showing that Mr. Pierce was aware of these two elements for accrual of a legal malpractice claim more than 2 years before filing his complaint are clear, undisputed, and subject to no other reasonable interpretation. Now, I'd like to address some of the statements made by Ms. Secor in her opening statement. This is very important.
Can you tell us what the knowledge of these facts was? You rely heavily on this April 5th letter.
Yes, Your Honor, I can.
Can you tell us what language in that letter it is that you're focusing on?
Well, the April 5th letter is certainly the one that the trial court relied upon. It is certainly probably the clearest. The language I'm specifically relying upon, I'll just go through it with you. Number one, it's in paragraph one, Mr. Pierce states that he just had a meeting with Mr. Parrish. And Mr. Pierce states, and I quote, "He informed me that all the way back in November, your firm failed to ensure the proper filings were made to preserve and protect my rights," close quote. In paragraph number three, Mr. Pierce discusses Mr. Parrish's failure to prepare for a very crucial deposition in San Francisco. And Mr. Pierce says, and I quote, that basically this resulted in the latest ruling from the court. And in paragraph 10, Mr. Pierce states, quote, "Now I find out your firm has already been notified of your screw up by failing to keep up with the basic filings and thereby cutting the legs out from under me." And then finally, in paragraph 11, Mr. Pierce makes statements that can only be interpreted as threats to bring a malpractice lawsuit. And then finally, and I think this is by far the most instructive of the level of knowledge that Mr. Pierce had of his legal malpractice claim, he, in paragraph 15, he offers to reduce or to waive his right to a legal malpractice claim against Mr. Parrish as consideration for reduced legal fees. I think those paragraphs, Your Honor, clearly show not only did he have knowledge of facts from which a reasonable person would think they had a claim, he actually knew he had a claim. He was a very sophisticated consumer of legal products, as evidenced by, in paragraph 15, his attempt to get his legal fees reduced.
Does he speak anywhere in this letter of because of your failure to do this, that, and the other, I have been injured?
Your Honor, he does not use the word injured specifically, I believe. However, the functional equivalent of that, which I think is all that the law requires, he does say that. In paragraph 1, 3, and 10, at least, he does two things which I think are very instructive, and they dovetail nicely with the accrual statute. Number one, he mentions something that Mr. Pierce did wrong. And then number two, he discusses an actionable or an injury that he suffered in his case. That his case has been substantively compromised to a substantial and material degree.
Counsel, let me ask you with regard to that letter that you're referring to. I believe that was in April 2005. Is that correct? That's the April 2005 letter we've talked about a lot. What legal malpractice claim are you contending that Mr. Pierce was aware of when he wrote that letter in April of 2005?
Your Honor, I can't specifically say, and if I'm misunderstanding your question, please let me know. I can't specifically say what he thought his legal malpractice claim was, what was going on in his head, what he thought was the most egregious thing that Mr. Parrish had done. All I know is that from that letter, from his own words, at that point in time, he was threatening a malpractice lawsuit. And this is not just the only letter. There are two other letters. There's one in December 15th of 04, and there's one in September 9th of 2004. And this is an accumulation of accusations, an accumulation of recognition by Mr. Pierce of a litany of things that Mr. Parrish had allegedly done wrong in the case. So this is the same thing over and over again. And I think one thing Ms. Secor has done in the briefing and in her opening statement, that is incorrect. As she has equated accrual of a claim with that claim's ultimate success on the merits. I think that's clearly improper. If that were the standard, no claim would ever accrue because it would require you to look into the future to decide how successful that claim would be at trial on the merits. And we can't do that.
Well, let me ask you this. Throughout these proceedings, these legal proceedings, is it possible that Mr. Parrish could have committed malpractice on numerous occasions?
I believe it is possible.
And in April of 2005, how would Mr. Pierce have known or have reason to know that Mr. Parrish would commit legal malpractice by failing to show up at trial and represent him during trial?
Your Honor, if I may, I believe this accusation about the abandonment, that's part of the motion to supplement the record that the court denied. And maybe so, I think it's something the court should disregard because Ms. Secor in her brief, in her opening brief, failed to cite to the record and for any factual support that there was an actual abandonment. Now, she cited that Mr. Parrish was ordered to represent Mr. Pierce. However, there is no factual support and no citation to the record from Ms. Secor that he actually did not appear. And in fact, I think that the elements of that information should be disregarded for the reasons stated, but just to venture into that briefly, there are multiple documents in the motion to supplement the record as exhibits, which clearly show that Mr. Parrish offered to represent Mr. Pierce if he so chose. Mr. Pierce then, by finding of the court, the district court found that Mr. Pierce knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered into the settlement agreement with Tyco. So I think if you look at those two things, there's no abandonment, and it's unsupported by the record.
Mr. Hicks, let me then clarify your position. Is it your position that once someone becomes aware of legal malpractice, then that is the date of accrual and it applies to all subsequent acts of malpractice, or can somebody bring a complaint based on each discrete act of malpractice?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question. In my brief, I cited the Duell case. I believe it's Duell versus Pueblo First National Bank. And what that case stands for, and I believe this is supported by general principles of tort law, is that once a claim accrues, notwithstanding the fact that damages continue to occur, that is an issue of damages, not a reaccruing claim each and every time. Now, I understand there are special types of cases, such as maybe in the insurance bad faith context, where there's you can have a discrete lawsuit for each wrongful act. But under general principles of tort law and accrual, I don't believe that's supported by Colorado law. That once that wrongful act occurs, and notwithstanding that damages continue to occur, and this is a very important fact, I think, to understand about this case, is you have a continuing chain of alleged malpractice by Mr. Parrish. It's not one thing just that happened once. It's a continuation of things. And that's what's detailed in the letters, the three letters. It's December 15th of 04, September 9th of 04, and April 4th of 2005.
Are these three letters the sole evidence upon which you base your argument that they're the claims are barred by statute of limitations?
No, it is not, Your Honor. There's other evidence that I would rely upon and that the trial court relied upon. Ms. Secor, I'm glad you asked that. Ms. Secor made multiple statements in her opening statement, which I think clearly show that Mr. Pierce had a claim more than 2 years before he filed his complaint. For instance, she said that as of April 2005, Mr. Pierce was aware that Mr. Parrish had notified his malpractice carrier. In addition, she also said in her opening statement multiple times that Mr. Pierce knew as of April 2005 that Mr. Parrish thought he had done things wrong and that that had violated whatever some duty of care that he had to Mr. Pierce. I think if you look at those statements, the statements in the summary judgment response at the trial court, if you look at the letters and you look at Ms. Secor's opening statement, it's clear there are a multitude of pieces of evidence which show Mr. Pierce was aware of the general nature of the damage and that the damage was caused by the wrongful, allegedly wrongful conduct of Mr. Parrish.
Is there a difference between you are representing me, I don't hear from you, it seems I get these court documents and I don't see any you doing anything. Is there a difference between my being concerned about your inaction, your lack of communication, versus a case in which I have a malpractice case against you? In other words, I can tell you I'm dissatisfied with what you're doing so far, but does that mean that I have a malpractice case against you?
Your Honor, I believe in the hypothetical you just gave me, that would be a factual question. But in this case, accrual of a claim, although usually a factual question, could be decided as a matter of law because the facts were undisputed and they were subject to no other reasonable interpretation.
But the facts that you've given us are these letters and these other two statements that you made, and that's it, right?
May I confirm, counsel? Your Honor, the letters themselves contain multiple accusations of multiple wrongful acts. For example, not just the April 2005 letter, but the two other letters talk about a failure to serve discovery. There is, you know, also the failure to prepare for depositions. There is the motion in limine. Now, one important, very important point is, once the motion in limine was denied by the court, that became law of the case. That was a final order of the court. It was the damage was set in stone at that point in time. And so I believe that's clearly supported by Colorado law and the law from the other states that I cited in my brief. And if it may please the court, I would like to proceed with the rest of the topics I wanted to discuss, as my time is shortly about to run out. For instance, Your Honor, on the last topic, under Jacobson v. Schein, the pending appeal does not delay the accrual of a legal malpractice claim. That is very analogous and the functional equivalent of filing a motion for reconsideration, which is what Ms. Secor was talking about when she said the motion limit could have been re-ruled upon at some point in time. Statutes of limitation are very important. Society relies upon them, the legal system relies upon them, and it is crucially important as a matter of public policy that we have definite points in time and clear, understandable dates in which claims accrue. That is, we relied upon it for a very long time. The legislature has expressed that that's a strong public policy as found in the accrual statute. If you introduce this uncertainty into the process, I think it's going to be very damaging for the legal system. And in 2004, the Colorado Supreme Court, in the case of Morrison versus Goff, discussed making judicial exceptions, such as the continuous representation rule, to the accrual of legal malpractice claim. And I quote, the Colorado Supreme Court said, and this is on page 1057, Morrison v. Goff, 91P3D, 1050. And the court says, despite opportunities to fashion a judicial exception to this rule, Colorado courts have consistently rejected attempts to deviate from the statutory definition of accrual for a malpractice claim. And they cited approvingly Roker House versus Bendelow, Jacobson v. Shine, Morse versus Gere. Now, that case was slightly different because it was a criminal case and involved some other issues with accrual. But the Colorado Supreme Court has clearly, I think, expressed their disdain for introducing uncertainty or judicial exceptions to the accrual rule for a legal malpractice claim. And in this case, the continuous representation rule, I know it was raised by counsel, she didn't discuss her opening brief. There's three quick reasons why that should not be adopted in Colorado. It would not even apply, number one, it would not even apply in this case because Mr. Pierce was aware of the alleged malpractice before the law, before the termination of the representation in April of 2005, at the latest. The states that have adopted the continuous representation rule have uniformly held it does not apply where the client is aware of the malpractice prior to the termination of the representation. Number two, the court should not modify the accrual statute by adopting a judicial exception. That's kind of what I've already discussed. And then secondly, the second main topic before time runs out, there should be no equitable tolling in this case. It was not raised in the trial court, number one. Number two, there's no evidence that Mr. Parrish precluded Mr. Pierce from bringing a cause of action because he actually told him what he had done wrong in April 2005. And Your Honor, in the court, thank you very much for your time and for hearing my arguments today. That's all I have.
Thank you. And thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. And the court will now be